Well, thanks for getting back promptly after lunch so we can get started again. I usually need Bella to announce that the meeting's ready to start, and then it gets started.
We're starting the meeting. Jeff?
Well, I hope our next topic can generate as much enthusiasm and excitement as our last couple of discussions. The next topic we have on the agenda is this discussion of the auditing standards pertaining to subsequent events. We added the topic of subsequent events as a possible standard-setting item in response to when FASB put a project on their agenda for subsequent events. Historically, most of the literature around subsequent events resided in the auditing literature, and in May of 2009, FASB issued FAS 165. I don't know the new code, Tom, do you?
No, and I never will.
FASB issued a standard which requires public companies now to evaluate subsequent events as of each reporting period and through the date the financial statements are issued. After FASB issued that, we didn't feel it was necessary to issue any changes in our standard in response to the FASB standard on subsequent events. However, as part of our review of the standard and getting up to that point, we did take a look at it and think that there was possibilities for improvement in the standard for auditing subsequent events. And so we've kept it on our agenda. And what we wanted to do today was to talk about the subsequent events standard and get some input from the SAG members as to whether or not you thought this was an area where we should improve standards and could standards be improved, or do you think this is an area that we should drop to the a lower end of our priorities. But I'm sure each of you or many of you are aware of instances where investors have been surprised by developments that occurred shortly after a set of financial statements was released, either significant losses being recorded in the next quarter or even in some cases companies filing for bankruptcy shortly after the financial statements were filed. And I guess the question is, you know, could or should audit procedures intended to identify material events between the balance sheet date and the date the report was issued have identified such events in some of those instances? And are the existing auditing requirements pertaining to subsequent events robust enough to identify important material subsequent events? So we'll turn the discussion over to Barbara Vanich to lead this and then look for your input. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. AU Section 560 is the board's existing standard that establishes audit requirements regarding subsequent events. It defines subsequent events as events or transactions that occur subsequent to the balance sheet date but prior to the issuance of the financial statements, which have a material effect on those financial statements and therefore require either adjustment to or disclosure in the financial statements. The first discussion topic for this afternoon has to do with the current audit requirements for identifying subsequent events. AU Section 560, which is included as an appendix to the briefing paper, requires that certain audit procedures be performed by the auditor after the balance sheet for the purpose of ascertaining the occurrence of subsequent events that may require adjustment or disclosure. These procedures include, for example, reading the latest interim financial statements and comparing them to the financial statements being reported on, reading minutes of meetings, making inquiries regarding any substantial contingent liabilities or commitments or changes in the capital stock, long-term debt, or working capital from the balance sheet date through the date of the auditor's inquiry, and also obtaining written representations of officers, executives, and clients' legal counsel. Given the potential importance of subsequent events to users of the financial statements, today we're looking for your view on whether these existing procedures might be supplemented with additional requirements or revised. For example, as I mentioned, the standard requires the auditor to inquire of and discuss with officers and other executives having responsibility for the financial and accounting matters as to whether any unusual adjustments were made during the subsequent period. AU Section 560 could be modified to explicitly require the auditor to perform tests on non-standard journal entries in the subsequent period to identify subsequent events. Another example might be to require the auditor to perform analytical procedures on accounts identified as significant risks relating to the latest available interim financial statements instead of the current requirement to read and compare the most interim financials to the financials being reported on. This brings us to our first discussion topic. Should any of the existing audit procedures for identifying subsequent events be strengthened? Should the standard require any additional audit procedures? And if so, what would they be? Galen Hansen?
Let me just share a few of my thoughts on this. Yes, I do think, and in fact, a number of these things I have always done, I was taught to always do, and I thought it was part of the standards. And so this was sort of refreshing for me to go through this to really realize what is required and what I think I probably have been doing on an optional basis for a long time. But tests of non-standard journal entries, I think it should be required, the analytical procedures. We do final analytical procedures, so I'm not sure where the crossover with that is. Also, another thing to think about is whether to require a review of subsequent financial statements. I think most people are already doing that, but that could be added to the list. And key performance indicators. Going down my list here, substantiating information in the subsequent events footnote. Actually, you know, what is required in that footnote? What do we mean by audit any of the information that is included there? Looking at significant subsequent transactions, not just the journal entries. Again, over the years, I've always looked at subsequent cash disbursements, significant subsequent receipts of cash, but that could even be extended to stock transactions. So those are some of the types of things that I think could be beefed up in that standard. I think there probably should be a requirement to discuss this in your exit or in the wrap-up with the audit committee chair in terms of significant items that floated to the top. So that could be considered. I think also specifically with respect to fraud, and I think this comes up in the Repo 105 type of situations, do we have sort of a reminder that that's something that we need to make sure that we've considered. And that's kind of my hit list.
So you're saying in the last one there, sort of update your where you think there are fraud risks in the company, update your considerations of
yes.
those fraud risks?
Yes.
Thanks, Gail.
Paul Sobel.
Thank you. A fairly quick comment. AU 560, while I know it's intended to be more broad, almost gives the implication that aside from general counsel, the primary focus of inquiry will be with accounting and financial folks. And I know that's not the intention, but that may be the way it's interpreted. My experience is that, particularly post Sarbanes-Oxley, disclosure committees, I think, do a very good job of trying to vet subsequent event information through the disclosure committee, and that it would probably be useful guidance. I don't know about a requirement, but useful guidance to the audit firms to make sure that they understand what that disclosure committee process is, and certainly consider interviewing some members of management who are not necessarily directly involved in accounting but may still be aware of events or transactions that may be bubbling up that should be considered.
Thank you, Arch.
When I first looked at this, I guess perhaps I had the same thought that Galen had, and that's what's the practice issue here. We've been dealing with subsequent events literature for a long time. One thing, by the way, I think that probably needs to come out of this standard is the accounting that's in it now and shouldn't be there any longer with 855. But in light of the things that, that Galen said, I think a lot of those things are in fact being done because the underlying principles of all of that are currently in the standard. And you might say, well, we could use some additional guidance and additional thoughts on things to consider, but I'd hesitate to get into a long list of rules because it's that seems to me to be taken completely away from a risk assessment process that should exist even in connection with the subsequent events. So I'd be cautious in that area.
Thank you. Doug Anderson?
Actually, I'll leverage just a little off of those last comments. When I read the standard again, it's been a while since I'd read it, it looks pretty old-fashioned is how I think of it. And what is it missing? One is it's missing a primary focus on risk, right? The auditor should be focusing on those areas that have the highest risk of identifying a Type 1 subsequent event. And it doesn't say that. In fact, the intro to paragraph 12 basically says the auditor generally should do these things. And it would imply, regardless of risk, what you're doing, we expect you to do these five things. And in my experience, the one in that list is probably the most useful is 12F, which says other things you think necessary. Right? And so I would rewrite it basically saying do the risk assessment, analyze those areas where you have the highest possibility of a type 1 subsequent event you want to deal with, or type 2 for disclosure, focus there, and then do those. On some of the specific areas, I would echo Paul. I don't think the focus should be on accounting and finance people. It should be on the inquiry should be with people that have responsibility for the economic events or the issues that could drive accounting as of the end of the year. I think we shouldn't be analyzing just interim financial statements. You should be looking at data and KPIs because a lot of this work will be done before interim financials are issued and published. So look at data. And then reviewing minutes is nice, but my experience is most corporations' minutes don't say a whole lot. And so I would look at more internal communications. Again, all within the umbrella, targeted to those specific areas where there's risk that you might have a material event that you missed a Type 1 subsequent event.
Thank you very much. John White.
I didn't go back and look at AS5 again on this point, but it seemed to me that one of the logical safeguards here would be that when you were looking at ICFR, that you would make sure that you had procedures in place. I mean, I realize it's done as of the end of the year, but that you should have robust ICFR procedures in place at the company that looked for subsequent events, and that obviously could also take you all the way up to the to the actual issuance date. That wouldn't be cutting off at the report date. But I mean, I don't know whether there's something needed additional to get to that result, but that seemed to me to be a way that it's putting the burden back on the company, but you'd be auditing for that at the time you did your ICFR audit.
Yeah, I'll comment on that because in looking at the analogous standard of the IAASB, which was written much more currently than the auditing standard on subsequent events that we have, there is a requirement to obtain an understanding of the procedures management has to identify subsequent events, and I think that's your point, that's what are the internal controls that management has to identify subsequent events that need to be accounted for or disclosed. And it sounds like something that could be in our standards.
I would have thought so. I mean, yeah. I thought that's a very effective way of, in effect, putting it back on the management.
Right.
And as I say, get you to the issuance date, to the extent that you're dealing with any gap there.
Right. One additional thing that's in the applicable ISA, and I think it's a tone thing, but I think maybe it does make a difference, is it says the auditor shall perform procedures designed to obtain sufficient appropriate audit evidence that all events occurring between the date of the financial statements and the date of the audit report that require adjustment over disclosure in the financial statements have been identified. So it's more of a statement that the auditor has to design procedures to identify events that need to be disclosed, whereas our existing standard to me seems to be more of a do certain things, and if they come to your attention, ensure it's reported. So I think there's a different tone in our current standard compared to what this objective is here. Does it sound that way to you also? Owen, you have a card up.
Yeah. I agree with the risk-based approach, and certainly the objectives, I think, are more important than just a listing of procedures. And in terms of looking at the controls, I think the part of the controls you look at on the AS5 are the financial statement close process. So even though we're opining with controls as of a certain date, part of the financial statement controls process evaluation is, you know, what happens after the end of the year with respect to the subsequent events evaluation.
Galen?
You know, Marty, this does remind me a little bit of the conversation that we've had about the going concern, and it strikes me as being a subsequent events footnote. It's part of the financial statements, and maybe I could ask Tom. I mean, is the FASB looking at it updating any of that standard with respect to the accounting or the disclosure requirements? I don't mean to put you on the spot here. But.
No, we issued Statement 165 right. That brought into the literature subsequent disclosure requirements and made it part of the U.S. GAAP.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. With that, we'll move on to our next discussion topic. This relates to the auditor's responsibility for identifying subsequent events in the period after the date of the auditor's report through the issuance of the financial statements. AU Section 560 provides that for purposes of the audit, the period with which the auditor must be concerned is considered to extend from the date of the financial statements to the date of the auditor's report. AU Section 530 states that the auditor dates the audit report no earlier than the date on which the auditor has obtained sufficient competent evidence to support the auditor's opinion. However, AU Section 530 also states that the auditor then has no responsibility to make any inquiry or carry out any auditing procedures for the period after the date of his report. In the staff's view, and at least in practice for larger U.S. companies, we believe that audit report dates are now often dated very close to the date that the financial statements are issued, and therefore the time period not covered by subsequent event procedures may be relatively limited. However, IFRS has a different requirement in that companies preparing financial statements under IFRS consider subsequent events through the date the financial statements are authorized to be issued. This date can occur sometime before the issuance of the financial statements and could result in a longer period correspondingly not being covered by the auditor's subsequent events review. Now, it's important to note that when an auditor's report is going to be included in a registration statement filed with the SEC, additional subsequent events are procedures after the date of the audit report. For example, when financial statements are included or incorporated by reference in a registration statement, the auditor performs subsequent event procedures similar to those in AU Section 560 up to the effective date of the filing or as close as is reasonably practicable in the circumstances. However, keeping in mind that not all financial statements are currently included in or incorporated by reference in a registration statement, our next topic for discussion has to do with whether or not, in your view, the auditor should be required to perform additional procedures similar to those in AU Section 560 to identify and evaluate subsequent events through the date of issuance of the auditor's report, or could any procedures during this period be limited to at least inquiries regarding material adverse effects? John White?
I guess my first reaction is it's not clear to me why there should be a different standard between the two time periods. I looked also at what large U.S. companies do, and at least a quick survey suggested that I looked at the 25 of the Dow 30 companies that had reported so far this year. And I think 22 of the 25, the two reports, the report and the issuance date were exactly the same. and the other three were one day, and seven business days difference. So, I mean, for at least for larger companies, it's the same date already. But let's assume that it isn't the same date. I guess I don't quite see why you wouldn't have the same standard. I mean, you do it if you have, if you've got a, if you're doing a registration statement, or if you've got a shelf in place and you've got a consent as part of the 10K, then you've got to bring it down to the date of the filing of the 10K in the same sort of way. I just didn't see why there is a difference.
Yeah, there's a difference in the existing standards.
No, but I mean, I didn't see why there should be.
Why there should be, right. Yeah, that's sort of why we're bringing the point up here that, as you suggest, when you're doing a filing under the 33 Act, you have to bring the subsequent events right up to the date of the filing, whereas under the 34 Act, effectively, if the report date is 2 weeks before, current standards say you don't have to do anything between the report date and the date of the filing.
I mean, maybe somebody from one of the accounting firms can enlighten us of why there is no gap. I was assuming on the large companies there's no gap because most of them have shelves in place. And so you've got to do consents anyway, and so you couldn't afford to have a gap. But, I mean, you'd have to – but I don't know why – is there a reason why it's kind of gotten to be no gaps?
Yeah, gaps on the – between the filing date and the audit report date?
Yeah, yes.
That was the result of 165.
Yeah.
I mean,
the company must evaluate subsequent events through the filing of the financial statements, and therefore our audit procedures and our audit report will cover the same period.
I'm sorry, then what are the two different discussions we are having here then?
Well, there's not a... I guess what Kevin is saying is that practice has changed as a result of 165, that since companies have to evaluate subsequent events up through the date they file their report, auditors are effectively doing that as well and dating their audit report essentially about the date of issuance or very close to the date of issuance, as your brief survey showed. Right. So I guess the question that we're posing here is maybe this is a standard whose time has passed or needs to be changed. Lynn, you had your card up?
Yeah, Marty, I actually have a question for you and the staff. Obviously, the board has a lot of important projects on its agenda, and it's looking at taking this one up. That would tend to tell me that the board has seen problems in its inspections. I mean, there must be some reason you're taking up the subsequent events now. So my really twofold, why are you doing it now in light of some of the other priorities on the agenda? And two, are there problems that you're seeing? And if so, what specifically are the problems you're seeing in auditing practice in this area? Because that would help me respond to the questions then.
I touched on this maybe before you stepped back. It was added to our agenda because FASB had put subsequent events on its agenda, and so we wanted to see if we needed to do something in response to that. So that's why it was initially put on. We're considering whether to keep it on as part of this discussion we're having today. But I think I did point out that, over the past couple of years, I think a number of investors have been surprised after financial statements have been filed that in the next quarter companies took large losses and or in some cases went into bankruptcy. And the question arises, should or could subsequent event procedures between the financial statement date and the report date potentially have identified the deterioration that took place, and therefore are the subsequent event procedures in our standards robust enough?
Right. If I could add, Lynn, I think that there, in the triennial firm 4010, there are some instances where firms were written up because they did not comply with the existing standard, but there would be no findings related to facts places where the firms had not done enough, but they had done enough to be in accordance with the standard. So I think it gets to what Marty said is, if the standard were more robust, we might have more findings in this area.
I think that's the point. And I think we're hearing from Galen and others that In fact, their practices that they're performing are in excess of what the current standard would seem to require. And the applicable ISA, upon which many of the firm's methodologies are built, is more of a principles-based requirement to identify subsequent events that need to be adjusted or need to be disclosed, which is a stronger principle than is in our current standard.
Well, I'd certainly agree with you then, changing the tone of the standard to more of a positive, you need to go search versus just here's 10 things you need to look at. I think that's certainly much more positive and certainly would take it up through the issuance date. As someone receiving financial statements, if the auditor was aware of something before it got filed, I would expect the auditor to go address that or stop the filing. So I think that would be very positive as well. I think some of the issues are not auditing issues. The issue about failure to disclose surprise losses, ITAC has addressed this and written a letter to the FASB on it. You may want to get a copy of that letter. But some of those really revolve more to the, not to the subsequent event type notion, but to the auditing procedures that were done around and surrounding loss contingencies and whether or not the FASB disclosure requirements in that respect are sufficient or not. And, of course, they've had a project ongoing on that seems to have gone one direction, turned around, and gone back to where they started from. So.
And an ED will be coming out very shortly on that one.
Good. Thanks, Lynn. I hope that cleared it up a little bit. Sam?
I never thought I'd say this, but I think I agree with Lynn here. but as long as you don't kiss me on it, I'm okay. I think as I read the paper, I had sort of three observations. One is, is this a burning enough issue? Are there practice issues that need to be rectified? Secondly, to Lynn's point, is this a project that's worth the resources to bump something else on your agenda? And the third point is, and maybe to Marty, to your examples. All bankruptcy filings and all large write-offs occur after some other quarter. So, I mean, I think the other thing that needs to be taken into account is I think AU 560 was probably written at a time when there wasn't the same continuous reporting obligation that exists. So, I mean, as to your question number two, do we need to do more work between the report date and the issuance? Because we're worried there might be 3 or 4 days in there, and that those 3 or 4 days are going to materially change the financials. I have to sort of question whether the cost-benefit really would bear itself out there when, in fact, if something is material, a company's got 4 days to actually get it issued on an 8K, and you know, I think the paper doesn't recognize the continuous disclosure obligation that companies have. So other than that, I probably wouldn't object if you took up the project as long as it was principles based. But otherwise, I'm not sure you got enough here to bump something else off your agenda.
Sam, thanks for those comments. I think your point actually gets to the second part of the question on this is, you know, what would be really the effect on when auditors would date their report and other maybe more practical things that would occur. So, Galen?
Yeah, it would seem to me that, and I agree with both Lynn and Sam, this should be a sort of a principle-based approach. You go out and search, but the auditor needs to know what to search for and what are we actually looking for. While I wouldn't want to see it overly prescriptive, you know, there should be a search part of this, but then it seems to me that you still have kind of your eyes open part of it. you know, what do you become, are you aware of anything? And that would go to maybe this gap that Sam was talking about, this 3-4 days. I mean, is the company going to go to hell in a handbasket in 4 days, you know, in that gap? I doubt it in most situations. But what if you become aware of it, of something that just pops up? So I think you have to. Somehow you have to figure out how to, at least on a principle-based notion, cover that gap.
Well, thanks for the input. As we said when we introduced this, this was actually on our agenda and added when FASB was taking on subsequent events to see if we needed to amend our standards. And this input was intended to see should we keep it on our agenda. So I think we've gotten some good feedback and appreciate the input. Barbara, is that?
No, thanks again for your remarks.
Good. Well, the next subject on our agenda deals with the auditor's report and the auditor's reporting model. We've discussed this. Well, first of all, the auditor's report has probably been discussed forever. And we've heard a lot from users in terms of investors about what their needs are, and they feel that they need more. And so Steve Harris was going to introduce this topic and make some introductory comments. Steve?
Well, Marty, as you mentioned this morning, this session is a follow-up to last April's discussion of what information should be contained in the audit report. And as you also indicated, the content of the auditor's report has been the subject of a long-standing debate over the last century. And with rare exceptions, the issues at hand today are not new. While the conclusions of what should be in the auditor's report have varied over the years, the fundamental issue is clear: whether the current pass-fail nature of the auditor's report is enough. A number of you at April's meeting indicated no, and similarly during the PCAOB's inaugural Investor Advisory Group meeting in May, that same sentiment was expressed by the Investor Advisory Group members. The CEOs of the international audit networks have also in the past recognized the need to address this subject. The issue has been highlighted and raised squarely in the international community as well, as a result of the recent economic crisis by, among others, Michel Barnier, the new Commissioner of Internal Market of the European Commission, Stephen Hadrill, the new CEO of the Financial Reporting Council in the UK, and in a report by the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales. Stephen Hadrill has asked rather bluntly, do we need to change the audit report to make it more useful, and do we need to see more said in front of the audit report about risk and the business model, and should the auditor provide greater assurance about such matters? The Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales found that the audit report did not provide useful information to users. So this subject is now highly topical not only in the United States but internationally. A cursory look at the voluminous literature describing the pros and cons of what should or should not be in the auditor's report will confirm that this is not an easy topic. Whether some have suggested the report should be expanded to discuss such things as what are the biggest reporting risks, the highest quality description of what is going on, the auditor's responsibility for directing fraud, how the auditor determined materiality, or is supplemented with a separate, more robust report such as the auditor's discussion and analysis, these are just some of the concepts that need to be considered. What is clear, however, is that investors want more. As a follow-up to the April SAG meeting discussion, today the Office of the Chief Auditor will present a potential two-phase project approach. Given the PCAOB's mandate, quote, to protect the interest of investors in the preparation of informative, and I stress informative, accurate, and independent audit reports, close quote, I'm hopeful that we can finally move ahead toward modernizing the audit report to better suit the needs of investors. And now I will turn it over to Bella to introduce and describe the potential approach.
Thank you very much, Steve. At the April SAG meeting, the SAG discussed the ACAP recommendation to, one, clarify in the auditor's report the auditor's role in detecting fraud, and then, two, to consider improvements to the auditor's standard reporting model. There was a lot of good, lively discussion in the breakout groups and then after the next day during the summary session. And two things that kind of came out that the Office of the Chief Auditor heard. One, there was general agreement among the SAG members that there should be more information in the auditor's report to explain the auditor's responsibility around fraud. There was less agreement, however, regarding if and how the current auditor's reporting model, the pass-fail model, could be improved. The SAG discussed that investors and users of the auditor's report need more information from the auditors, but a consensus was not reached as to how best to provide that information and to what extent and how much information needed to be provided to the users and investors. The discussion also focused on whether an addendum to the auditor's report or amending the actual auditor's report would be appropriate and what information would need to be included in either one. Because there was consensus on one aspect of the ACAP recommendation and less agreement on how to proceed on a second aspect of the ACAP recommendation, several SAG members recommended that the staff undertake an immediate project to clarify in the auditor's report the auditor's responsibility around fraud and then conduct additional research and outreach to ascertain additional user needs relating to the form and content of the auditor's report and propose potential solutions. Today, I would like to actually present a possible two-phased approach that the Office of the Chief Auditor has developed to consider changes in the auditor's report and seek the views of the SAG. Phase one is the shorter-term project that encompasses potentially making several specific edits to the auditor's report regarding the auditor's responsibility around fraud. Phase two is a longer-term, multi-year project that will encompass research and outreach to users and others regarding the form and content of the auditor's report. Let me now turn to phase one and provide a more detailed description of what the Office of the Chief Auditor is considering. Phase one includes several items that were discussed with the SAG at the April meeting and for which there seemed to be agreement. At this point in time, the Office of the Chief Auditor is considering recommending to the board the following changes in the auditor's report. Point one, OCA is considering adding the wording, whether caused by error or fraud, to the following statement that's required in the auditor's report currently. The statement is, those standards require that we plan and perform the audit to obtain reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements are free of material misstatements, whether caused by error or fraud. OCA is also considering adding a concept to the auditor's report that explicitly states that reasonable assurance is a high level of assurance, but is not absolute assurance. OCA believes that these two changes will more clearly articulate the auditor's responsibility for detecting material misstatement, whether caused by error or fraud, and also describe to the users the reasonable assurance is a high level of assurance. The next change OCA is considering is recommending to the board is adding an explicit statement to the auditor's report that the auditor is independent as required by applicable rules and regulations. Although there is already a requirement in the board's auditing standards that the title of the auditor's report include the word independent, and obviously there's a requirement that the auditor needs to be independent when conducting their audits, the staff believes it would be informative to users if the auditor made an explicit statement in the auditor's report regarding their independence. The auditor is already required to make this type of communication to the audit committee on an annual basis by the board's Rule 3526, Communications with Audit Committees Concerning Independence, and the staff believes that this will enhance the audit report. The final change the staff is considering as part of phase one is adding a requirement to the audit report to be addressed to both the board of directors and the shareholders. Currently, the auditing standards do not specify to whom the audit report should be addressed to. The audit report is typically addressed to the board of directors or the audit committee of the issuer. The staff believes that investors, as shareholders, have a vested interest in the audit of the issuer, and therefore the staff is considering recommending a requirement for the audit report to be addressed to both the board of directors and the shareholders. At this point, I would actually like to pause and ask a few questions of the SAG regarding their views on whether the potential changes I've just outlined in the auditor's report are appropriate in phase one, and if there are any other changes to the auditor's report that the staff should consider to be addressed in phase one. Jim Cox?
I don't disagree with any of the changes. I will just comment that I'm underwhelmed. I would think that most users believe that the auditor is independent, that there's an independent standard. I would also believe that most people reading the language would understand what assurance means. It's not 100% assurance. You know, I do see the significance on behavior of adding the or fraud language, but I think that that's really at the margins of what else could be done. If you were asking me about how we could really make this communication more important to investors, you know, I would think that whether it be in the formal report or a collateral document or somewhere, even in an SEC filing with, you know, perhaps some necessary safe harbor that would be facilitated by the SEC, I don't know, would be something that the auditor is supposed to be doing anyway and does do, and that is identify to the audit committee and then memorialize that by making it public what the critical accounting choices were, what the critical accounting estimates were, and what the critical assumptions were in the preparation of financial statements as perceived. I think if you did something like that, that would be overwhelming, not underwhelming.
Jim, if I could respond to you. Actually, that is something that we'll be looking into under phase two of the project.
Right.
That's dealing with the longer-term project of looking at the actual form and content and the additional information that users are looking for and what is the best way to provide that information.
So until that moment, I'll remain underwhelmed.
Hal Schroeder.
I'm going to continue to be underwhelmed as well. Last night at dinner, we had a kind of a similar discussion as to what should go in the auditor's report. And I can recall in my audit days, we prepared something called a summary review memorandum that summarized very much as the good professor was describing, you know, what did we do, why did we do it the way we did it, what were the key results. And to me, that tells you so much more about the company that, you know, all this is window dressing, frankly, at this point. I'm being much more interested in seeing the second phase of the project.
Okay. Lynn Turner?
It would help me, once again, if you could tell me what the time frame is for phase one versus the time frame for phase two, start and finish, and I'll tell you why. A number of years ago, I recall when the FASB called us, a number of us up and said, we're going to work on improving pension accounting. And what do you think of breaking it into phase one and phase two? And a number of us said, well, improving pension accounting is important, so let's go do it, but when are you going to do phase two? And it was, well, after phase one. And to date, they've never done phase two, you know, quite some period of time later. And often phase ones just become an excuse not to do phase two. And so you do the light lifting first, and the regulator or standard setter never get around to phase two. So I think it's difficult unless someone says, okay, when am I going to do phase one? If this is to expedite through a piece of it and get that done relatively quickly, but at the same time you're working on phase two and you know that'll take a little bit longer, then I think that's probably fine. But these days, you know, I'm not that trusting of regulators and standard setters. So my notion is, tell me that in fact you're going to do phase two and tell me what you're going to do in phase two. And that allows me to respond, because if this we'll do phase two when we get down to phase one, then no, I don't believe that works.
Well, Lynn, I think you must have been reading my mind, because actually we're, our recommendation is to actually do both phases at the same time. So now wait for phase one to finish before starting to doing the research and the outreach for phase two. And since there seems to be quite a lot of excitement to see what's actually going to be in phase two and rather than phase one, let me just kind of go through and outline what we have for phase two and then open it up for questions.
And could you also give us some notion of timetable?
There's a slide on the timetable at the end. Basically, okay. Both projects would start in 2010. No. Let me now kind of outline what the OCA is considering for recommending to the board under phase two, which is broken out into three parts. This phase will specifically focus on the form and content of the auditor's report and what additional information users and investors need, and it's the best vehicle to provide that information. Part A will involve conducting research and on potential changes to the auditor's report and outreach. Phase two will involve holding a roundtable to discuss the information obtained in the research phase and to seek additional feedback. And then phase three will be to assess that feedback received and determine next steps. More specifically, as part of Part A, OCA will conduct research and outreach to the users and ascertain and others to ascertain and identify the additional needs. Specifically, we plan to ascertain what information pertinent to the audit and activities of the auditor helps the users make a decision to invest in a company, and what information do users believe is necessary and required to be relayed to them by the auditor. We also plan to monitor, as we are currently, the development of other standard setters and regulators studying the topic, IWSB, ASB, IASCO, and others, and also monitor the FASB disclosure project framework as it relates to investor and user needs for enhanced disclosure. Once we have conducted our outreach and research, we would hold a roundtable to discuss the information obtained during the research phase and seek additional feedback. We would present an overview of the research conducted, facilitate a discussion regarding the additional user needs, and facilitate discussion regarding the potential solutions and challenges of additional user needs. After the roundtable, we would assess the feedback and determine next steps, which would include coming back to the SAG for further input as needed, and also present a staff recommendation to the board regarding a potential project relating to updating the form and content of the auditor's report. As it relates to the timing, OCA is recommending working on both projects simultaneously, as I just mentioned. After today's discussion, we would plan to assess the feedback we received here on phase one and phase two and consider recommending to the board under phase one proposed amendments to the interim standards. We also plan and have started conducting research and outreach as it relates to phase two on the potential project. Next year, in 2011, we plan to recommend to the board the proposed amendments to the interim standards, and as part of phase two, finish conducting the research, subsequently hold a roundtable, followed by assessing the feedback and determining a recommendation to the board regarding the potential project. So at this point, now that people have seen the full scale of, I guess, both approaches, I'll open it up for comments, and I know that Doug and Jeanette had their tent cards up, and I'll let you have the first say. Doug?
All I was going to say is if the intent was phase one to find those things that were non-controversial that you could push through very, very quickly, I think you found those as underwhelming as they might be. I mean, if that was the intent, I went back through my notes from the last meeting and my recollection of the discussion, I don't think you'll get a lot of pushback. In fact, if I think about your timetable now, I would say it's pretty conservative for what it would take to get those things approved, because I don't think there's a lot of controversy over those.
Jeanette?
I guess I was questioning the need for a phase one and a phase two, especially if you're going to do it concurrently. The whole process of putting something out for exposure and making adjustments and then doing it again on a more comprehensive basis takes a lot of your resources, could be confusing to the community. And what if in phase two you find that you want to strike some of what you did in phase one? So I would advise just to go to kind of merge it all together and just do it as one project.
We appreciate that comment. There was some debate, I think, on that subject at the last SAG meeting. As just, well, I guess I'll call it, some SAG members said, I think the term, there's some low-hanging fruit here in terms of just improving the existing audit report, and why don't we go ahead and try to do that while you take a longer view to the others. But if the view is the low-hanging fruit is of such low value, and that some of the commenters around here seem to be indicating that, that it sounds like the preference of the SAG members is really let's tackle the bigger, more important, tougher issue and just build the lower-hanging fruit into that. So that's the message I heard from you, and maybe that's the same message I heard from Jim Cox and Hal.
Lynn Turner.
Marty, I still think the things you got in the phase one are good, and quite frankly, you already got the language all but done. So if you could
just move ahead and get that out in short fashion, I think that would be helpful. But I am nervous about your phase two because you keep using the word potential, and which turns around and tells me you're not committed to it. And I'd feel a lot more comfortable if that word potential was scratched out of these slides after the Treasury Committee report and what you've heard in the CFA survey. I can't comprehend how it could be considered a potential project. I think it's absolutely something that has to be done, and it you know, the slides just tell me you're not committed to that yet, which is very troubling.
Well, let me try to comment to that. I think we're being cautious in some of our words here in terms of what the staff is doing, and since we have to make recommendations to the board, we can say there's a potential standard if the board approves it. So maybe that's the language that's catching your attention. I think that what we're laying out here is we definitely want to get to a solution to this. As Steve Harris said in his comments, this has been around, this question seems like forever, on how to deal with the user and investor needs. And we want to lay out a program here that conducts research to try to really understand what those needs are. We've heard a lot of those needs being we want more, but we really try to want to get more concrete information as to what that more is. And then once we get more research around that, to hold roundtables with investors, auditors, audit committee members, and others, which would be the third bullet here, is to develop potential solutions. It's been debated for a long time as to what do we do. Let's get to a real solution to this to try to get, you know, to get an answer and get a supplemental audit report if that's what's needed, and then get back to the SAG after that, and then for us to make a recommendation to the board. So potential is meant in that kind of regard. And it's in the 2011 time frame because we think, obviously, it's been around for a long time and don't think we're going to solve what this additional audit report should look like in the next 6 months. And so we're looking at this as a, you know, with 2010 into, well into 2011 project, and then but with a recommendation to the board in 2011. Is that helpful?
Yeah, very much so.
Galen?
Yeah, what I'm hearing is a lot of angst about getting this out as soon as possible, and I think that would be consistent with the Treasury recommendations. Let me ask you one question, though, if you might get your input on that. Is this just strictly related to the audit report? What about interim reviews and interim review reporting? And am I throwing too much into the mix here? But it seems to me like that might be ripe for reconsideration in light of the AICPA just updated their standard on reviews. It's called SARS-19. Added an additional paragraph, talks about additional, considerations there in the interim reviews. And at some point, isn't even a review report required instead of being optional? So it seems to me like interim reviews might be a topic to consider at some point.
I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I'm a proponent of reports being issued in connection with quarterly reviews. That's not in the jurisdiction of the PCAOB. That's an SEC matter as to whether the SEC requires reports in connection with quarterly reporting right now, and the SEC does not require reports in connection with interim reviews. But if the SEC were to require such reports, certainly you wouldn't see any objection from me, and I think we'd be looking at those interim reports. Brian, I don't know if you have any comment on that. No? But the main focus of the project, though, really, Galen, although I agree with your point about interim reporting, I think the main project here is to address what we've heard, what we clearly heard at the Investor Advisory Group, what we've heard from users elsewhere, and heard at the last discussion in the SAG meet around this, and that is the content of the audit report needs to change. It can be two reports, one on, so it's not confused, one the current pass-fail report so readers can clearly see that the financials present fairly or not and not confuse things, but additional information in some type of a report that helps get at the matters that Professor Cox referenced before. What were the critical estimates? What were the critical judgments? What were the most controversial areas of accounting policy and things of that nature that I think, Jim, you touched on? So I think that's the focus of the project.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I just wanted to second that. I think investors have spoken pretty clearly, as you just said, on this issue. They do want an improvement to the auditor's report. There are some differing views about what that improvement should be, but I personally, and I think many investors, would fall down along the lines of Professor Cox's explanation of what that information should be as a supplement to the auditor's report. I think that's where many of them be. I would not say that that's where all investors are, but I think many investors would converge around that solution. As we know, the Washington Post had a story the other day, as I'm sure you all read, where their view, one reporter's view, was that the PCAOB has been slow to act and weak-willed. And I'm hopeful that as part of this project, you can demonstrate to that reporter and to others that they were wrong on both counts.
Kiko Harvey.
Just a question, really. If you go out with this two-phase approach and you tell people that they're going to change some minor wording things, which are kind of all of a do-no-harm kind of change, are you also going to explain to them that there is a second phase coming and have some more description about it, or is that going to come kind of I realize these are all public and that people will probably get the word out, but a little more descriptive information about what that second phase may result in, because I'm kind of afraid of really driving the costs up of the audits, you know, without any real good reason. And so I think that, you know, dropping new language in, even as small as the language may seem, my sense is we'll have some sort of interpretation as it starts to bubble down through the firms that, you know, you need to do more now, even though it was already in the existing standards. So I'd like to see some sort of language about if you make the first changes and the language changes, that you don't expect these will have any additional cost considerations for audits, because reality is your standards already really required you to do this to begin with. Make sense?
Yeah, thanks for the comments. I think some of your questions we haven't fully thought through about what information we'd make available, but as you indicated, these are public meetings, and I'm sure with the press here and others, they'll at a minimum be aware of our detailed project that we're committed to on phase two that investors seem to be interested in, but what communication we ultimately make about that, I think we need to discuss with the board. Thanks.
Steve Harris.
Jeff, just to respond very briefly to what you brought up, this discussion at the SAG does not preclude the next meeting of the Investor Advisory Group. I mean, this is a top ticket priority for the Investor Advisory Group, as a number of the investors at this table have mentioned before. And so we will be working in tangent with the SAG and with the board. But I don't want anybody to be misled to think that, you know, the one group or the other is preempting. This issue is front and center, and I would anticipate that among the topics that will be brought up at the next Investor Advisory Group meeting, whenever it is, will be the auditor's report and the model and what they aggressively would like to seek as well. So I just want to leave you with that understanding.
Thank you, Steve. Lynn Turner.
Just to follow up on the last two sets of comments, as you do your research, I think the real question is to incorporate into your research whether or not investors are willing to pay the cost for whatever you're asking for in the way of the audit and the audit report. And I think as long as the owners of the business are willing to pay for it, then that should drive the answer. Are they willing to pay for what they want? And I think that's a reasonable thing to ask in the research. But I think that is really a question for the people who own the business, the investors.
Tom Linsmeyer.
Just one small nit for someone that has the job of writing words. One reaction I have under the language is the auditor is independent as required by applicable rules and regulations. It sounds like the only reason the auditor is independent is because of rules and regulations. And I don't know whether that's really the image that you want portrayed. The as required by seems that would be the interpretation that I'd have. Consistent with, or is defined by, or is defined by and consistent with, something like that would seem to, you want to define what independence is, but it sounds like it's dragging and screaming is the independent.
Point. Thanks, Tom. Noted.
Point noted.
Do people have any other thoughts on anything else that OCA should consider as it moves forward to trying to put together a proposal for the board to consider? You're tired from this morning's discussion?
I think they're tired of the discussion of the auditor's reporting model and saying, get on with it.
I got that. The weight is on my shoulders.
So thank you for that. I think your comments are helpful in terms of ensuring that we drive this through to a successful conclusion. It's as has been said, it's an issue that's been around for a while, and we want to get to a solution. So that's... we're driven towards that. With that, I think we can turn to our next subject and our final topic of the day, which is an update on the Communications with Audit Committee's project. And Dan Gelzer was going to make some introductory comments. Dan.
Okay. Thank you, Marty. As Marty's indicated, the next topic is the board's proposed standard on audit committee communications. And Jennifer Rand is going to summarize what we heard in the comments on the proposal that was published last March. But I'm just going to kind of briefly set the stage. As I said at the board meeting on this subject last March, it seems to me that one of the fundamental objectives of Sarbanes-Oxley is to strengthen the role of the audit committee by putting it at the center of the relationship between the public company and its auditor. The provisions of the Act that deal with the committee's oversight of the audit are kind of based on the idea that both the work of the audit committee and the work of the auditor can be strengthened to the extent that there's good communications between the two. But building on that objective, we did publish a proposal at the end of March that would try to enhance communication between auditor and audit committee and also put more emphasis on it as a two-way process, not simply information transmitted from the auditor to the committee, but more of a dialogue between the two. We received 35 comments on that proposal, reflecting, I would say, a wide range of differing views. To me, at least two things came across. One is a number of comments suggested that we needed to do more homework, more outreach on this subject. Some thought we'd approach the subject too much from the perspective of the auditor and without a full appreciation of what audit committee members wanted and needed. Along the same lines, other comments can link this to the subject we were just talking about and pointed out that there could be similarities between the information that should be communicated to the audit committee and what investors would like to learn, or what additional information investors would like to learn coming out of the auditor's reporting model project. Based on those comments, there were suggestions from a number of people that we needed more insight from investors, auditors, management, directors, others with an interest in the process before we go further with the project. The other point that stood out to me was the several comments, or many comments, emphasized that we needed to be careful not to turn auditor, audit committee communications into an exercise where the primary objective was to check a lot of boxes as to what had to be communicated. I think there was general agreement that the audit committee benefits from the auditor's insights into the strengths and weaknesses of the company's financial reporting, but that we needed to guard against overwhelming audit committees with a lot of information that wasn't necessarily useful to them or causing the auditor's communications to become more scripted and more of a compliance exercise. So with all those comments in mind, I think one thing that the board has decided is that it would be desirable to have a public roundtable on this topic to consider some of the things that we heard in the comment letters and other suggestions about audit committee communications. We would like to hold that roundtable as soon as possible. Schedules being what they are, that probably means, probably in September rather than next month, which is a difficult time to schedule meetings. We will probably reopen the comment period around the time of any roundtable, since there does seem to be a lot of interest in this subject, and it may not be possible to have everyone with an interest in speaking at the roundtable to actually be part of the program, but we do want to give everyone an opportunity to express any additional views that they may have. So with that little bit of introduction, Jennifer is going to be more specific about what we actually heard in the comments.
Thank you, Dan. I'd like to first provide an overview of who we heard from, who commented on the proposal. Dan mentioned 35 commenters sent in letters to us, and we are very grateful for the feedback. I think we felt that we had a wide range of feedback, and this shows you the outline. Certainly, firms and association of accountants provided, just if you look at total count, they provided the largest number overall of any particular group. But we also heard from audit committee members and associations, issuers and internal auditors, investor representatives, and a couple others. And we are very pleased with the different type of feedback we heard, and we saw some consistent themes among some of them, but we also saw some different views. So with that, I'd like to provide you with an overview of what commenters said. And these are the types of issues that, as we put together what the roundtable topics will be, the types of issues that we'll be seeking additional feedback on, as well as we hope when we do officially reopen the comment period, we'll get additional comments on these and certainly if there's any other issues. Overall, what came clear to us is there certainly was support for a revised standard. People recognize the importance of auditor audit committee communications, also recognize the current standard and the board's interim standards is directed that it isn't required that the auditor establish this understanding, at least with the engagement letter with the audit committee, and thought improvements could be made really to align the board's existing board standards with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act requirements. So there was overwhelming support for the standard, but with that, like with any of our proposals, there's areas, you know, for suggested improvement. So I'd like to go through different recommendations that commenters provided to us. First, as Dan mentioned, an overwhelming theme that really came from not just one particular group. Certainly audit committee members had this view, but also the Center for Audit Quality encouraged additional outreach about what issues audit committee members are interested in. There was some view that the requirements in this proposed standard really geared toward maybe what auditors would like to say as to audit committee members as a result of the audit, but there may be other issues, additional things, and so commenters really encouraged us to develop a standard that would be meaningful to audit committee members and their oversight, and that could include some additional things, and encouraged us for that additional feedback, which is why Dan mentioned the roundtable and an additional comment is something we're pursuing. Another point was it encouraged us to clarify the process related to the evaluation of two-way communication between the auditor and the audit committee. Certainly, it was recognized that there is the importance of effective two-way communication between the auditor and the audit committee. And in previous discussions with the SAG, when we've talked about this topic, that's come up as being very important. But the comment that came through in comments that came through in this regard is, well, how do you go about really objectively evaluating those, you know, whether or not the two-way communications were effective? What should that criteria be? And also another comment was the requirements, proposed requirements we had in the standard were not helping to promote effective two-way communications. So really just comments on better ways to articulate that, better requirements, better direction on what we're trying to achieve there. Another area relates to the audit engagement letter. So that's the letter that the auditor provides to the audit committee and the services to be provided in connection with the audit. And in that, in the proposed standard, it includes different required elements. One is disclosing the auditor's responsibilities and also management's responsibilities. And several commenters suggested to us that the audit committee's responsibility should also be included in that letter. So we had several different commenters express that view. Just moving to the next slide. Additional themes, considering management's communications to the audit committee to avoid repeating certain requirements. We have several requirements in the proposed standard really around the area, most particularly about accounting estimates. And we had language which we intended that the auditors would not be duplicative of management's communications. We certainly recognized in developing the proposed standard that management would be communicating certain matters to the audit committee, but nonetheless, we thought the auditors should evaluate that, perhaps not duplicate things that they didn't see if it was necessary. But there seemed to be confusion around how we articulated that and thought we could better describe what the auditor should do in considering management's communication so that it's not completely duplicative. There was also a suggestion about clarifying which consultations outside the audit engagement should be communicated. Several commenters talked about not really clear on where the lines were as far as what constitutes a consultation. You know, if the engagement team consults with someone else, for example, they may want to just call someone to get clarification on an accounting standard or how that's applied. Would that be considered? Would they need to communicate that? Kind of, you know, water cooler conversation, national office, kind of, excuse me, what is that, what is in the scope of that? And also some were concerned that if it was just too broad, it could have the unintended consequence of discouraging such consultations, which certainly would not be beneficial. Moving on to the next slide, we had mixed views in certain areas. One was regarding whether all communication should be in writing. And this is an area that we've sought the SAG's feedback, and we heard mixed views regarding SAG members about permitting flexibility, permitting some communications be made orally, others in writing. Other SAG members thought that all should be in writing. That same view seemed to persist in the comment letters that we received. So we were not able to reach a consensus view on that, and people brought up, you know, very good reasons for which side, you know, that they were on, whether or not there should be all in writing or whether flexibility. Another area of mixed views is whether all corrected misstatements, including those detected by management, should be communicated to the audit committee by the auditor. Many had concerns that as management is going through the financial reporting close process, that, you know, certainly their system of internal controls would identify areas of misstatement, and part of the controls of the company system would identify those and correct them. So there was some concern about how much, you know, bringing all these adjustments in, is that going to have a negative, you know, just duplication, not necessary. It's part of the company's internal control system. And so there were views on whether or not that was an appropriate communication by the auditor. And then finally, and Dan mentioned this too, there were some concerns or different views that the proposed requirement in the standard could just create this check-the-box mentality, that it appeared to some that what was in our proposed standard was a lengthy list of required communications, that perhaps those required communications were not getting to the heart of issues, and again, kind of going back to the first point, what was truly important to the audit committee in connection with their oversight of the audit and the financial reporting process. And so just encouraged us to kind of revisit what's required so that it's not too many and that they are appropriate. So with that, that's an overview of the significant comments that came through, and thank everyone here on the webcast for providing comments on that. We're certainly going to continue exploring this issue. It's an important issue, and we recognize the importance of hearing from audit committee members and others and continuing to debate this and get feedback before we recommend to the board that they finalize the standard. So with that, I'll open up the floor if there's any comments on going through the comments. Doug Anderson?
I just had a question. So is the expectation that after the roundtable you come out with another exposure draft, or do you not know at this point?
In my view, and I see Marty is about to jump, in my view that might be premature. I think it depends on, we're certainly open to the feedback, and I'd personally be reluctant to prejudge the outcome. So a lot of, the commenters did encourage us for additional feedback, and we plan to do that in two parts, the roundtable and reopening the comment period. And so I don't want to prejudge what may come out of that.
I think without getting in trouble with Marty and Jennifer, I think it's fair to say that if we make significant changes in the proposal, then we will re-expose it. And I guess you can draw your own conclusions from what you've heard about whether that's likely or not.
Thanks, Dan. Paul Sobel?
It seems obvious that a key constituent for this roundtable will be audit committee representation. Have you given some thought to how you're going to make sure you have sufficient representation, whether it's there's a few different audit committee organizations, or would it be directly with audit committee members, and would you pull the plug on it if you don't think you have representation or sufficient audit committee representation?
We have, but that has been a significant consideration for us, given the composition. We do want to have a good number of representatives from audit committees, and also we heard from constituent groups of audit committees, so we're interested in that as well. Broad feedback, the types of entity, who they may be audited by, different industries. So we are looking at, because the audit committee members or views that were provided weren't necessarily always unanimous. They had different views, too, about what may be important to them in connection with the oversight of the company. So we are very much interested in that. That's a key driver in the roundtable composition.
Yeah, I'll echo Jennifer's point there. We would expect to have significant representation of audit committee members and a diverse group of audit committee members, and seeking such groups such as the NACD to recommend, for instance, certain audit committee members to attend. So we'll be doing some outreach to get the right constituency at the roundtable. Damon, is your card? Yes.
I commend you on that, what you just said in terms of reaching out to a diverse and sort of engaged group of audit committee members. But I think it's probably important to keep in mind here that the interaction between auditors and audit committees is they are all agents, meaning that you wouldn't want to get into a situation where the mutual desire not to be, to A, not inform, and B, not to be informed, it's viewed as the last word on a matter.
I think we've heard mixed views on that, and that's a good point, that there are some audit committee members that express, I don't need to get all this information, I don't need to hear all of this, and there are other audit committee members who say, I can't get enough. So that's our standard is somewhere between there, I guess.
Well, perhaps I express myself in too cryptic a way. I mean, I think that the point here, I think, is that the board, in looking at a standard here, needs to be mindful that, I mean, there are some situations where you, in public policymaking, where you have essentially two constituents and there isn't much else to the story, right? And then you take their views into account and try to figure out a fair way of balancing them. In this matter, there are, although you are prescribing a standard for communications between two parties, it's the broader investor and public interest that is being served by this communication, and that's what the board ought to keep in mind.
One criticism we got about the proposal was that some communication got back to us that this is terrible. Audit committee meetings are going to go from 30 minutes to 3 hours. We wanted to know which companies had the 30-minute audit committee meetings. Barbara pointed out that, yes, the roundtable would include not just audit committee members and auditors, but a broad constituency, including, clearly, investor groups as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, if there are no further comments on that, I think we've worked our way through the agenda. I think everybody got a little bit tired out of the session on FASB and IASB. But then we had the main event in the morning as well. So just in terms of, I'd be glad to take any comments anybody else has on any topic that we've discussed or other emerging concerns that you have that we should be thinking about. I certainly take into account some comments that were made of, given how many important things we have on our agenda, make sure that if there's some minor things that we talked about, maybe put them to the bottom of our agenda because there's clearly some big ones, and good point there. With respect to broker-dealers, the point was made, take advantage of what's out there already, work with the SEC, FINRA, expert panels, et cetera, understand the risks with respect to customer assets that are not on the balance sheet, they're not off the balance sheet, but it's trillions of dollars, and ensure that our standards are robust in that area and move expeditiously. So that's going to be an important matter for us. I have added to our staff, and some new additional people are coming on. The FASB projects will be important to us, and clearly that discussion emphasized the need for PCAOB to stay very involved in those, to understand the auditability issues. Issues came up about questions of diversity in practice that could occur, judgment framework, pressure on closing, and therefore implicit implications on audit quality. So these matters will have tremendous amount of our attention going forward with us working closely with FASB to talk and understand and address auditability issues. All right. Damon?
I mean, you invited sort of into the weeds. I'd like to go up one level of generality. I've had to be in and out today, so perhaps this has already been mentioned, but I mean, I think that, you know, the board has labored under a certain amount of uncertainty for a long time. In terms of litigation and the like, and that is sort of over. And I'm very, and I've had a great deal of sympathy, and I think many of us around this table have, for the ambiguous position that put the board in. I think it's clear that you are, the staff is, and your team in particular, Marty, are working very hard at this stage to sort of take up a lot of business that perhaps in a different world might have been taken up earlier. And I just wanted to commend you for that and express my appreciation of the people I represent, for all the work you're doing. And in particular, I note for your responsiveness to our body, I'd take one example. We've had some discussions here about concerns around audits of international firms and the like, and there was recently an announcement, I think, representing the kind of consensus view here about some things that maybe ought to be done in terms of advising investors about risks associated with some audit practices there. I think it's indicative of sort of how responsive you've been to this body, and I just want to say how pleased I am, how much I appreciate it.
Damon, I appreciate the comment very much, and we'll continue to try to be so. With that, I guess brings to closure today's meeting, unless anybody has any further Comments or further business? John White.
Just one other thought that occurred to me. We were talking about the 500 firms that do the non-public broker-dealer audits. I don't think any of them are represented on the SAG, and maybe when you're thinking about new members.
There are 500 new firms that have registered because they didn't otherwise audit issuers. Certainly the firms that are around this table, I think in each case probably audit some non-public broker-dealers. So there are representatives around the table who audit non-public broker-dealers right now, but there are 500 new firms registering who previously had not audited any issuers and therefore weren't. But we take your point that when we're looking for new members, maybe somebody out of that constituency might be appropriate as well. Thank you.
Well, one other point, I mean, one of the things the board probably going to want to discuss is whether to have a rather aggressive outreach to these firms, perhaps as a parallel, thinking about our outreach to the smaller issuers, smaller auditors, or more specifically firms that audit smaller issuers, that series that was 6 or 8 meetings a year. So this is something we'll have to discuss at an appropriate time.
There's nothing else, and meeting adjourned. Thank you very much.